Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
If you voted in Texas on Super Tuesday, you had to pull out your driver's license or passport or handgun license in accordance with a still controversial law. Some people say voter ID laws prevent fraud. Others worry they prevent otherwise eligible voters from exercising their rights. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. This modern-day acrimony may be ripped from the headlines, but as my guest will tell us, it could also be ripped from the history books, time and time again since the very founding of the Republic. Despite our proud legacy of democracy, we have a long and nearly unbroken tradition of simultaneous efforts to either expand or reduce the voter rolls. Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. His new book is called The Fight to Vote. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
To the extent that we have always fought over who deserves to vote, what does that say about the trust we place in the act of voting?
In some ways, what it suggests is people understand how important it is to be able to vote, how central it is both to citizenship but also to power. And as I had the chance to look back throughout history to ask if the fights of today over voter ID, over other laws that I argue restrict voting, over even things like Citizens United and the role of money. The question that endlessly arises is, are these challenges new? And it turns out that they're intense. These fights are consequential. They're controversial. But they're not new. As you said, we've been fighting about who can vote and how to make it matter from the beginning. And that didn't start last year, and it didn't start 50 years ago at Selma. It goes back all the way to the time of the country's founding.
So we were building this new country, knowing that we wanted a different system from what had existed in England. But the founders' thinking was shaped in part by what existed there, and that was a society that granted power to those who already had some wealth.
At the time of the American Revolution, only white men who owned property could vote, basically. And that was a rule handed down from England. It actually dated from the Middle Ages. And when the Americans rebelled and broke with Great Britain and had one of the first great Republican revolutions of the modern era, they really weren't thinking so much about this question of who could vote. But if you look at the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, in so many ways articulates our founding creed, Jefferson wrote that government is legitimate only when it rests on the consent of the governed. And that was an important idea, and it began to sort of take on a life of its own. And so this notion that only those white men with property could vote began to be controversial even at the time of the Revolution. Benjamin Franklin led a working man's revolt in Pennsylvania in 1776 that won the right to vote for all men, regardless of whether they had property or not. And Franklin said, you know, if a man owns a jackass, the man can vote. But if the jackass dies, the man no longer can vote. So who really has the right of suffrage, the man or the jackass? There were others who wanted to keep things as they were. John Adams was sort of aghast at the Pennsylvania experiment. He said that when he was urged to expand the right to vote, he said, you know, women will demand the right to vote. Lads of 18 will think their interests not attended to and will demand the right to vote. And men who have not a farthing to their name will think themselves worthy of an equal voice in their government. He said, there will be no end of it. And of course, that's a pretty good description of what happened over the next 240 years.
Well, Abigail Adams famously liked the idea of women having some power to vote. Did anybody seriously consider women's suffrage at the Constitutional Convention of 1787? Would it have even been broached?
Well, no, it would not have been. It's interesting to note that one of the things that was significant about how they treated voting in the Constitution is that they didn't mention who could vote. They actually left out that issue because different states had different rules. New Jersey actually allowed women to vote until 1807. In an early example of voter fraud, some men went to vote dressed as women. So, of course, in 1807, they disenfranchised the actual women, not the men dressed as women. But in the Constitutional Convention, it's really a fascinating thing when you look. You know, James Madison took these extensive notes, and they were secret for half a century. They weren't supposed to be published. And it's almost like a transcript. And they really considered whether to write this property requirement into the Constitution. And they decided not to. But what they were really worried about, what Madison was really worried about, were the kinds of manipulations and shenanigans and rules that could disenfranchise otherwise eligible voters, especially, Madison was worried, passed by state legislatures. He thought state legislatures would rig the rules for their own supporters. And they actually put a provision in the Constitution that gives the Congress and the federal government the power to override state voting laws because they were worried about exactly the kinds of things that actually have happened a lot and I would suggest have happened in recent years in state capitals all over the country, including Austin.
Has gerrymandering for political gain been practiced equally by whichever party is in a position to do so at a given time?
It is emphatically the case that gerrymandering is a beloved hobby of both parties whenever they can. There's no question about it. And it's gone back to the beginning of the country's history, and that was the kind of thing that Madison was worried about. And ironically enough, he himself, when he ran for the U.S. House of Representatives in the very first congressional election, he got gerrymandered. His enemy was Patrick Henry, you know, give me liberty or give me death. Who was opposed to the Constitution. And he drew the first congressional district that Madison was running in so that the only part of the district that was basically pro-Constitution was Madison's house. And Madison had to run very hard. They ran a charismatic but not quite as bright war hero against him, James Monroe. In order to win, Madison had to flip-flop on a major issue. The first great American political flip-flop. Madison had always been against having a Bill of Rights. He had written the Constitution and he defended it in the Federalist Papers and thought it was
good, perfect,
as
right.
It was. And to win the vote of the Baptists, who were an oppressed religious minority in the district, he had to reverse himself and say, oh, now I'm for amendments. And I always was all along, you know, that was then, this is now. And that's why we have the Bill of Rights, because he said he committed to a religious freedom amendment. So there's been gerrymandering from the start, and there's been unequal representation of different kinds of districts from the start. What's happened in recent years is that the parties have gotten really good at it. It's gotten computerized, and it's gotten so that when a party has control, they're really able to draw the districts so that there's almost no competition, and they get many extra seats. And in the last decade, that has been the Republicans who've benefited from that. Emphatically, a lot of the control that the Republicans have in the House of Representatives in the U.S. Congress, at least some of that comes from their success in gerrymandering.
Before we move on from the founders, I just want to ask a question. I want to understand what the justification was for limiting voting rights to people with property. We'll leave aside men and people of color for a moment because we'll talk about that in a minute. But was the idea that there was more education available to people? I mean, how did people justify to themselves this idea that only if you own things did you deserve full citizenship effectively?
Yeah, no, it wasn't education because none of them particularly were educated the way we would regard it. It was that the argument was that you had to have independence and a stake in society, skin in the game, and that you had to be able to vote your own way. And only if you had the independence that came from owning property, that the theory went, would you have that. And there was a little bit of a wrinkle that makes it a bit more understandable, which was in those days, everyone voted in public. It wasn't a secret ballot. And so there was a greater risk that people would get paid for their vote. And they were worried that poorer people, they had all these kind of convoluted arguments that poorer people would sell their votes more. And so therefore you shouldn't let them vote. And it's actually better for them not to be able to vote. And that they would, James Madison, and this is perhaps relevant in the current moment of this political campaign, Madison fretted privately at the Constitutional Convention that if you let everybody vote, regardless of property, that the country was going to change a lot, that it was not just going to be farmers anymore, that there'd be immigrants, there'd be factory workers, there'd be what basically became America. And he said that you could get people either combining against those with property, or they could follow a leader of opulence and ambition who would be a demagogue who would sway them. And so therefore, they shouldn't have the right to vote. And, you know, there are at least some candidates in this race who that is a pretty good description of. They were very worried of the sway of certain kinds of political figures over the masses.
We have great reverence today, understandably, for Abraham Lincoln's role in freeing the slaves and granting voting rights to black men. But his conversion to both those positions took some time.
Absolutely. And that is, you're right, that is one of the great stories. And again, one of the things that to me was fascinating was how political and how central to the life of the country these issues of building democracy were. So you had in the 1820s and 30s, the first big voting rights breakthrough was giving the vote to white men who didn't own property, in effect, the white working class, what we talk about today. But the next great challenge was African Americans and slavery. And you're right, Lincoln was not originally an abolitionist, and he was emphatically not for giving the vote to black men. But as on so many other things, he changed, and he changed in the crucible of the war. And, of course, we know he, partway through the war, issued the Emancipation Proclamation. But he had always been against giving the right to vote, and his first stabs at Reconstruction did not enfranchise African-American men, former slaves. But he came to recognize that, among other things, so many of the soldiers in the Union Army were black men and former slaves, and they'd earned their place at the table of democracy. So he changed his view, and it was quite significant. Just a few days after the surrender at Appomattox, he gave his first speech about what he wanted to do with Reconstruction, with the post-war order. He spoke from a second-floor window at the White House. And he said, you know, some people have criticized my plans for not giving the vote, and I now agree with that. I think that those who've served in the military or the educated, he started listing the ways that black men could vote. And at least one listener caught the significance. John Wilkes Booth was there, and he gasped, that means citizenship. That is the last speech he is going to give. And he tried to get the guy standing next to him to shoot Lincoln on the spot. And when that man refused, Booth swore, well, by God, I will put him through. And, of course, we know that that is exactly what happened at Ford's Theater. And it was very consequential for the country, at least in part. I don't think John Wilkes Booth was a big Abe Lincoln fan to start with, but it was at least in part what sparked that act of murder and assassination. And as you may know, there really was a very significant move that happened. The 15th Amendment, pushed by the Republicans, gave the right to vote to the former slaves. You couldn't discriminate based on color or race. And there was a flowering of democracy. You had voter turnout among black men of 90%. Hundreds of them were elected to legislatures, Congress, governor, senator. It was a brief moment of possibility that was crushed by the Ku Klux Klan and violent backlash and political cowardice.
All right, I have to jump in here. My guest is Michael Waldman of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. His new book is called The Fight to Vote. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, Michael Waldman. His new book is called The Fight to Vote. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. So, Michael, the 15th Amendment was ratified. It never went anywhere, but you had Klan intimidation on one side, and also states and municipalities and counties, particularly throughout the American South, passing things that essentially codified racist policies that kept African Americans from voting. My question is this: where was the Supreme Court?
One of the interesting and perhaps unexpected aspects of this story is that the courts and the Supreme Court, most of the history of the country, did not play a major and certainly not a positive role in expanding the right to vote and protecting it. The Supreme Court had what was called the political question doctrine, and they understood that these issues were often very partisan. They upheld or allowed those Jim Crow constitutions to go forward, even when they said, gee, this does seem to disenfranchise lots of people, but there's nothing we can do about it. They simply stepped aside. And that was the way it was throughout the country's history until relatively recently. And, you know, we the people, through constitutional amendments like the 15th Amendment and others, are the ones who've put the phrase the right to vote into the Constitution. It now appears in five separate amendments. While it's true that there's no right to vote in the Constitution as written by the guys in powdered wigs in 1787, there definitely is a right to vote in the Constitution in all the years since then. But it was us. It was political activism. It was legislatures. It was public argument. It wasn't judges who did it.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Martin on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Martin.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Something that I've always had trouble with reconciling is whether or not during that period of time, were the Republicans at that point in time considered the liberals, or were they conservatives as we know them today? Because they take such pride in going back to the, you know, what Lincoln did. And I just wonder if it's the same group of people or not.
It's a great question, because you hear this debate now all the time, where people are trying to take today's political groupings and say, well, actually, you're being hypocritical because it's different from your previous position. Back then, it was the Democrats who were pro-racist, pro-segregation, pro-Jim Crow laws. The Republicans were known as radical Republicans, and things didn't sort of fall quite so neatly on a left-to-right spectrum. But they were emphatically more for the right to vote and more for racial equality. But there was a catch. In the South, the Democrats disenfranchised the voters, the African-American voters, and poor white voters to boot. In the North, in the second part of the 19th century, in the late 1800s, cities began to fill with immigrants. And the challenge that people worried about was voting by immigrants and the working class population of those cities. And it wasn't immigrants, as people debate today, say, from Mexico. These were immigrants from Ireland, from Italy, from Poland, from Europe. And it was in the North, many of the Republicans, sort of the blue blood Republicans, suddenly discovered they didn't like universal voting rights either. And they passed laws there to make it harder for those immigrants and those working people to vote. So both parties kind of have done this at various times. It is fascinating, though, that throughout much of the 20th century, also, the Republicans were aggressively for the right to vote, while Democrats, who were enthralled to their segregationist wing, were much more reluctant. And in the period after this retreat for American democracy, at the beginning of the 20th century, you had a response, the progressive era, as it's known, was this time of ferment and reform where people really focused on fixing the institutions of democracy, on fixing the broken government, and on expanding the vote as one of the solutions. And it was Republicans like Teddy Roosevelt who were very aggressive, and it was Republicans more than anybody else who supported giving women the right to vote.
think a lot of Americans have sort of forgotten that we didn't gain the right to direct election of our senators until the 17th Amendment was ratified in 1913. How did that amendment change the political climate in Washington?
Well, you're exactly right, and it's discussed nowadays and misunderstood. That was their version of campaign finance reform. Previously, senators were chosen by state legislatures, and it was tremendously corrupt. And the legislatures were owned lock, stock, and barrel by the Gilded Age big businesses that had arisen by the robber barons of the time. And to try to overcome this, they passed the first federal campaign finance law, but they also said, let's give the people themselves the right to vote for the Senate. Now, it was not the case that Congress wanted to do this. The states themselves and the people in the states demanded it, threatened to call a constitutional convention, and forced it. And nowadays, as you may know, quite a few conservative legal thinkers and conservatives in Texas, Governor Rick Perry was a great voice on this, and also Senator Ted Cruz, have urged the repeal of the 17th Amendment. And the state legislature in Utah, I think a few weeks ago, voted for that. In other words, repeal the right to vote for Senate. And their thinking is that it changed the balance between the states and the federal government, that it was a power grab by Washington. And that, at least at the beginning, that was not what it was. It was actually forced on Washington by the states, who thought there was too much corruption and too much power for big money in politics.
We know when the 19th Amendment was passed to give women the right to vote, but why then? Why did it happen in the 19-teens after people had been talking about this for some time?
People had been talking about it since at least 1848, when the Seneca Falls Declaration famously urged a right to vote for women. But you're right that not a whole lot happened after that. And why did it happen when it happened? Some of it, I think, is the fact, and we saw it during the Civil War, that during wars, things get jumbled and people start to think differently and more nationally. But it was also the activism of a few young women who were mostly in their late 20s. Some of them had gone off to graduate school in England and been part of the suffrage movement there. They came back and said, you know what, we're going to do something truly audacious. We're going to actually try to pass a constitutional amendment to get the right to vote. And when Woodrow Wilson got off the train, he had just been elected president. He came to Washington, D.C. for his inauguration. The day before the inaugural, he got off the train expecting a greeting from a big crowd. And basically, there was nobody there. The Princeton Glee Club was there to greet him, but that was about it. And his aide said, where are all the people? And they were down at Pennsylvania Avenue. 5,000 women staged a march for women's suffrage for what became the 19th Amendment. And they were, many of them were wearing somewhat preposterous costumes, at least we would think they were. They were led by a woman on a white horse, dressed as a Greek goddess, carrying a banner. But they were also surrounded by 100,000 men, many of them drunk. They were there for the inauguration. And the men began throwing things and cursing, and they broke through the barriers and assaulted the women, sent 100 women to the hospital. This got huge attention. The police chief of Washington, D.C. had to resign. It overshadowed in its publicity, in some ways, the inauguration. And public opinion nationwide started swinging in support of women's suffrage because of this violence directed at those nonviolent marchers. And when I learned about this, I'm sure perhaps people might be thinking, gee, that sounds an awful lot like Selma 50 years later, which we all know about. But it has similar impact for the right to vote for women. Now, it took several years more of creative civil disobedience, of 2 years of nonstop picketing of the White House, of hunger strikes, but eventually... and partisan politics, because as I said, the Republicans supported this, the Democrats weren't so sure, and eventually it became part of the Constitution in 1920. It doubled the size of the electorate.
How long did it take for women to start voting? Was it immediate that women participated near the levels they do now?
No. Participation rates started low People were not used to voting. The phenomenon for many decades was that women voted in effect the way their husbands might have told them to. There was not what we see now, which is a gender gap where women sometimes vote for different candidates than men. It took a while, but it was not ultimately so revolutionary in terms of changing what the government did, although it was a big part of why they passed prohibition, because that was seen as something women were strongly for. We tend to overlook this fight for the right to vote for women. We sort of, in a textbook or something, you might say women were given the right to vote. But it was every bit as hard fought and as creative an effort as a lot of the other social movements that have come since then. I'll be honest, I didn't know this story. I work in a voting rights organization, mostly women. They didn't know this story. The name of somebody like Alice Paul or Lucy Burns or Inez Mulholland, these were the Martin Luther King and John Lewis of women's fight to vote. And it was a pleasure to meet them, as it were.
Why wasn't the Civil Rights Act of 1964 sufficient to restore and protect voting rights for African Americans?
You know, for all the drama and triumph of the civil rights movement, from Brown versus Board of Education through the 1950s, the sit-ins, and then the great victory of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, for all the change that wrought, it barely touched voting. Voting was too powerful, and it was the next thing, and it was not really included in the Civil Rights Act. And as the story has been told and retold, and it was told in the movie Selma last year, although not entirely accurately, I would say, there then began the push for the last great breakthrough, the Voting Rights Act, which would end legal segregation in voting and the incredibly effective repression of the black vote that continued for a century up until the mid-1960s throughout the South. And, you know, we know the story that Dr. King pushed for this, and when he would have fascinating meetings and jousts with Lyndon Johnson, Johnson would push back and say, now is not the time. I'm trying to pass the Great Society, which helps poor people. I need those votes. King decided to go to Selma, Alabama, one of the worst towns in the South, for African Americans to vote, in part to organize there, in part because they knew there'd be a reaction and the public would see it. And it's endlessly fascinating because you realize King is playing his role, and Johnson, as a savvy insider, is playing his role. Johnson never told King in these meetings that he was secretly writing the Voting Rights Act and actually had negotiated it with the Republicans. And King didn't tell Johnson, by the way, 2 days from now, we're going to march at Edmund Pettus Bridge. But as you know, they marched. There was a brutal assault on the marchers by the local law enforcement. It was televised nationwide. And there was a spontaneous national mass movement of outrage. And Johnson, a week later, went before the Congress, gave that memorable speech proposing the Voting Rights Act, and said, in the language of the words of the hymn of the movement, "We shall overcome." And it's fascinating to see sort of how it played out, because these were two viscerally talented political leaders, both from the South, and together playing their different roles, they helped create, along with a lot of very brave people on the ground, this epical change. And that was accompanied by a constitutional amendment to end the poll tax, and all kinds of other changes. A few years later, the voting age was lowered to 18, and it was a kind of a golden age, at least in terms of the rules for American democracy, that lasted for half a century.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phone, we have Charles in Dallas. Hi, Charles.
Hi, this is Charles from Dallas, and I was an election clerk at the most recent election of Super Tuesday, and I know that there have been steps in Texas to try and get more people to register, but we had to turn away dozens and dozens of voters because they had tried, they had registered at the DPS offices when they were getting their driver's license renewed, and we just had to turn them away because either their address was wrong and they hadn't changed it, or there was just no record of them in the system. So even though there are steps to try to increase registration, people still don't understand the process.
What do you know about that, Michael?
It's a very important point that Charles makes. You know, in the last 15 years nationwide, it's become once again something that people are fighting over. The Florida 2000 recount election, which was so crazy and so close, triggered for a lot of political operatives the realization that turnout mattered a lot, but also that you could win a lot if you could find a way to make it harder for other people to vote. And there have been a lot of legal changes, including in Texas. This year, in 16 states, you will have new laws on the books in, for the first time in a high turnout election, a presidential election, that we believe make it harder for people to vote, and that head in the wrong direction, in a sense, for the first time since the Jim Crow era. Now, Texas, as your listeners may know, has a very controversial voter ID law. And I'm actually for voter ID. In other words, I think that people should have to be who they say they are, and you know, it's not unreasonable for them to have to prove it. I'm against requiring ID that lots of people don't have, and about 11% of eligible voters nationwide don't have a driver's license and the kind of specific ID that these laws require. In Texas, a federal court found that 608,000 people don't have that ID, and found that it was unconstitutional and discriminatory, but the law is still in the books. And there was, among other things, confusion and challenges in what was otherwise a very low turnout election. And if Charles could yep. make himself available to my colleagues who are involved in all of this research and
Let me jump in
law.
Here because we have
to talk to him.
We have to get a break in 10 seconds. My guest is Michael Waldman. We're talking about his book, The Fight to Vote, back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law, Michael Waldman. His new book is called The Fight to Vote. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Michael, before the break, it sounded like you were going to recommend that our caller, Charles, contact the Brennan Center to see what could be done.
Absolutely. We would love to hear his information and his experience because it's important to know what really happened. And he can call us or give his information to the station or contact me at the Brennan, www.brennancenter.org.
Just to be clear, you mentioned that, you know, the new voting rights, voter ID law, in Texas disenfranchised 600,000 people. You're talking about 600,000 people who were previously and remain eligible to vote, are registered. This is not just in general. This is people who would have been able to vote before voter ID took effect and couldn't vote after.
Yes. A federal court, after an extensive trial, found that. And, you know, the Supreme Court in 2013, in a case called Shelby County, gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that great law that Lyndon Johnson others pushed for, and that really stood as the most successful civil rights law the country's ever had. The Supreme Court said, well, in effect, that was then, this is now, we don't need it anymore, and by a 5-4 vote. And just 2 hours later, Texas pushed through and implemented its voter ID law, and you know, it is known nationwide for the kind of mischievous way it's crafted, in that you cannot use your University of Texas ID as a government ID, but you can use your concealed carry permit, gun permit. The courts have found it several times to be discriminatory, to have a disproportionate impact on communities and voters of color. But as you know, it is still on the books while the legal process grinds on and on.
You're careful to note the difference between voter fraud and election fraud. One has been a problem in our history and one has mostly not been a problem.
Voter fraud, meaning the kind of problem that this kind of voter ID law stops. You know, a voter walks in individually and pretends to be someone they're not, is vanishingly rare. The most comprehensive analysis says you are more likely to be hit by lightning than to commit that kind of voter impersonation fraud in the United States. There has, however, throughout American history, been a rich pattern and history of misconduct and shenanigans, and it's really election fraud. In other words, it's always been politicians or political parties or the people who are in charge of the machinery of government and the machinery of elections stuffing the ballot box. That is something we should emphatically be on guard against. This is something that has been around. It was very much of a problem in the 19th century, much less so in the 20th century as time went on, although you had things like the 1948 Senate race in Texas, where it all came down to box 13 down in the south of Texas, where the votes were discovered after the election, where the voters all voted for Lyndon Johnson alphabetically and in the same handwriting. So, you know, there's a history there, but it is really pretty rare nowadays. Things are much cleaner. And when you hear people saying we need to take these steps because of the risk of voter fraud, very often that is just not factually accurate.
Lots of people listening will remember that the election of 2000, the presidential election, essentially came down to the results in Florida. People might be surprised to read that African Americans were 10 times more likely to have their ballots rejected in Florida that year. On what grounds?
All different kinds of grounds. Some of it, as we know, was the machines didn't read them properly, or there were errors in their registration, or errors in other things in terms of where they were listed as living. Florida also reminded us that it was a very political control of the election process. George W. Bush's state chair was the Secretary of State of Florida in charge of the election. Now, Al Gore's chair was the state attorney general who had to bring the lawsuits. So it wasn't only one party. But one of the things that the government of Florida under Governor Jeb Bush did was purge the voter rolls of people who were supposedly ineligible to vote, especially because they had a felony conviction. The rules are very, very restrictive in Florida. But it turned out that purge was a mess, and people were kicked off the rolls who were eligible to vote, certainly enough to overcome what we remember was ultimately a 537-vote margin that won the presidency. So it turned out that Florida revealed to us the many different ways that the election system generally had rotted and that we hadn't invested as a country or in our states in even just the technology to make it a modern, fair, free, and accurate election.
Now a lot of places have these electronic balloting systems. Sometimes you vote on a computer screen at your polling place. Do those eliminate the kinds of hazards we saw with the old punch card ballots or with the kind that you fill in with a Sharpie?
They really are better. After that Florida recount, Congress actually required states to move to electronic voting. A lot of people, especially kind of on the left side of the dial, got very worried that they were somehow rigged, that, you know, because the guy who owned one of the companies that made the machines said his goal was to try to win the state of Ohio for President Bush's campaign. A lot of people got worried. In fact, those machines, when they work well, can actually be better than the old machines, but they need paper records and all other kinds of things to make it so they can be audited. And And this is actually a success over time, that the country has moved toward a better system. That's the good news. There's unfortunately bad news. Those computers, those voting machines are computers now, and they're 15 years old. And we all know what a 15-year-old computer does. It breaks. And so in 43 states around the country, the voting machines are 10 years old or older, and in a big chunk of them, they're 15 years old. And a presidential commission of bipartisan that President Obama appointed said, hey, folks, we're going to have to go through this all over again because we're going to need to replace these machines. And I actually think that there's one of the things that gives me hope is this need to build a new voting system, because that can give us the ability not only to modernize how the votes are cast, but how registration is done. While there's been this wave of bad laws that make it harder to vote, at the same time, in many states, there are reforms that are now moving to improve elections and actually make it so more people can vote. The most important reform of all would be to move toward automatic and universal voter registration. Right now in our country, we put the burden on individuals and they fall off the rolls when they move, or there are all kinds of problems, or or political parties or outside groups doing voter registration. If we said that everybody who's eligible to vote is on the rolls, government does it, it's automatic maybe from when you're 18, it would add 50 million people to the rolls, it would cost less, and it would curb the potential for fraud. And you're starting to see states like California and Oregon just passed versions of this past year. New Jersey legislature passed it, but it was vetoed by Governor Christie. It's a breakthrough idea. I think it's the wave of the future. A part of the hope is to keep it out of the partisan crossfire. But in any case, not all the news is bad. There's actually a wave of reform and response on this and other democracy issues all over the country. Bipartisan redistricting commissions to end the gerrymandering. New forms of campaign public financing to try to step up against Citizens United and the role of big money that's now changing politics. There's a lot going on at the grassroots. That's a great encouraging sign.
Bipartisan redistricting seems like such an obvious idea that it's hard to understand why any politician could get away with acting against it.
And it's interesting because it is not, as it plays out in the states, a Democratic or a Republican issue. Partly because whose ox gets gored matters a lot. Mm. So you had a nonpartisan commission pushed in California by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, a Republican. Governor Kasich in Ohio actually just backed something similar there. There's also a commission that the voters put in Arizona, a different version of reform in Florida, but that doesn't use a commission, but that's pretty good. And the Supreme Court, interestingly, the U.S. Supreme Court does not like the system of partisan gerrymandering. It has just said it doesn't quite know what to do about it, what standard it could possibly apply that would be manageable. And that is, there was some cases out of Texas in the past 10 years where they ruled that way. But they upheld these reform commissions. They said, you know what, the people can take this task on themselves. This is another instance where it isn't really up to the judges alone. But we, the people, in our capacity as the ultimate lawmakers in America. So I think there's a lot of positive movement there.
Michael, 2014 turnouts for that midterm election were just incredibly low, like lower than they had been in decades for a similar election. Why is it so hard to get people who are registered and eligible today to show up and vote?
The turnout in 2014 was the lowest it has been in 72 years. And that was during World War II, and people had an excuse, a lot of them. They were overseas fighting. So we don't have that excuse. Some of it is these new rules. Some of it is the feeling that people have that their vote doesn't count, that redistricting and gerrymandering means there's not much competition, or that, as you hear people talking about in this campaign, they feel the system's rigged. In the last election, that same election, because of Citizens United, you had the top 100 donors gave more than the 4.75 million small donors combined. That's a level of concentrated political wealth that we haven't seen since the Gilded Age. So those are all reasons, but it's also that the people are not doing our part. Turnout in the United States has been low compared to other democracies for a long time. In this primary, in this 2016 presidential primary, Texas had the second lowest turnout rate in the country of any states with the primaries so far. There's a lot of reasons for that. Some of it is that the political parties have atrophied. They aren't in there rallying and organizing and registering and motivating voters. One of the things I came out of this research with was a great appreciation for the positive role that political parties play in doing this. We all roll our eyes at the partisanship these days, but these parties actually play a big role. So there's a lot of factors on turnout. It's hard to identify one, and it's not the case that just these new voting laws cause it, but they sure don't make it better.
What do you say to folks who have come to the sort of cynical assumption that all politicians are the same and all politicians are ultimately dishonorable, so their vote is really just a waste of time?
Well, I think that Florida race, for example, in 2000 shows that every vote mattered enormously. You could pick a president. That is true over and over and over again. And when you have a political system that's broken, where the politicians are self-dealing or where government is not meeting the needs of the public, it's often the voters who speak back, who make the change. Maybe one individual vote doesn't matter so much, but all our votes together matter greatly. And we fought and bled and died to create this democracy. We were the first continent-wide democracy in the history of the world, and it would be a great shame if we allowed it to slip away by our own inattention.
Are students running around the campus of NYU who might be voting for the first time excited about 2016?
I think so. It's such a crazy election, and it is a window, if nothing else. You know, if you certainly follow the results so far, at least on the Democratic side, there's a very strong vote, as we know, for Senator Bernie Sanders, and his argument. And we're seeing these democracy issues play out in this campaign for the first time in a long time. Sanders' central argument is that the system is rigged. He says, well, it's the billionaire class, and campaign finance reform is his priority. Donald Trump says he's the only one who can't be bought. And Hillary Clinton, while she's not as vociferous in her rhetoric, she actually, in Texas, put out a plan on voting that was the most detailed and probably the best of any of them. So whether we think those politicians are cynical or not, we are making them react to this very urgent national need.
Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, and he's author of the new book, The Fight to Vote. Michael, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.